Chicago. This is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, with occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by Anthony Anderson, Richard Boykin, Amisha Cross, and Reginald Richardson. Our program tonight coming from our home base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago, where our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email us a comment, it's Bruce Dumont at beyondthebeltway@museum.tv, brucedumont@museum.tv. Or if you'd like to tweet us a question, it's @Dumo. And again, if you ever want to go and see what the broadcast looks like or hear it again, if you missed it, you can go to beyondthebeltway.com, which is our website. Well, tonight we are going to put aside the discussion of ISIS and U.S. foreign policy. We've discussed it quite a bit in the last several weeks on this broadcast. We will do it again next week. And I predict it is not an issue that is going to go away in a week, so we'll have a lot more to talk about next week. But another issue that has dominated much of the news in this country really for the last almost 2 weeks now has been the issue involving Ray Rice, formerly of the Baltimore Ravens, and the actions of the football commissioner, NFL commissioner, Roger Goodell. We're not going to talk so much tonight about the future of the NFL. We'll leave that to others to focus on. But we are going to talk this evening for the next couple of hours about the issues that really have come to fore because of the video that was taken of Ray Rice and his fiance at the casino that was caught on security cameras released by TMZ. And really, it's made the world of football pretty topsy-turvy since that time. We're going to talk about the crime and the problem of domestic violence in the United States. And it was a story that expanded when the issue of alleged child abuse involving Adrian Peterson also came to the fore. So we're going to be talking about cultural issues tonight that are criminal issues, and sometimes when things happen in the world of big league sports, they're foisted on the people, and people have got to deal with it and discuss these issues, and that is what we're going to do in the next couple of hours. I would like to begin with you, Anthony Anderson. You spend a lot of your life over the last 22 years. You've spent working with young criminals in the Illinois juvenile justice system. You've described them as thugs, so I can describe them as thugs. They're paying their debt to society, but you're dealing with guys that have crossed the line. When you look at this story and when you look at the abusive nature of what we all saw on that video, what was your first reaction when you saw it?
My first reaction is that the abuse that I saw was all too common in most places, especially like the NFL or any other sports kingdom. The fact of the matter is, I've seen a lot of it, it's not to say that I'm condoning what happened, but it's almost like I've become a little disassociated with the whole premonition of violence because I've been so around it for so long. It's unfortunate that it has happened. Hopefully it won't continue to happen in the future. But again, that type of behavior just can't be condoned.
Amisha Cross, what did you see when you saw that video for the first time?
I think it was stomach-turning in many ways. It's one thing to hear about somebody in domestic violence cases. It's another thing to see live in color what exactly happened. And watching that and thinking, they still got married. This was a fiancé at the time.
Right.
They still got married post that, as well as knowing that the NFL had decided that they were only going to give him a 2-game suspension, knowing that they had already seen the entire video was problematic.
As a woman, what did it tell you, or how did you react when you knew that the woman who had been abused in that video ultimately married the guy who abused her?
As a woman, it was hurtful. But it was also taking me back to all these psychological studies that I've read about women in abusive situations. In a lot of cases, you don't feel like you can get away. And physical abuse often stems from psychological abuse. And if you've been beaten and battered in terms of people saying things negative to you over time, it makes sense that you would stay. There are a lot of women every day who are still in abusive relationships.
Dr. Reginald Richardson also joins us. He's a PhD. He's from the Family Institute at Northwestern University. He's done great studies in the issue of abuse with people of color and their actions. What did you see when you saw that video, and did you expect the type of tumult that followed?
Well, I think whether or not the kind of media attention that's been drawn to this issue has been good in that we know that 1 in 3 women experience abuse. We know that women, 1 in 4 women will experience sexual assault by the time of 18. What this did was it created a face for abuse. It began a national dialogue about domestic violence and intimate partner violence. And so I think that that's helpful. Whether or not the NFL did what it should have done, I think is immaterial. For me, what I'm interested in is this conversation around why does abuse happen? What are the factors that continue to create abusive situations? And why do women stay? And what can we do about that to help people who are in that situation?
Richard Boykin, you are a man of politics and you're also a man of the cloth. What was your reaction when you saw the video and, again, the tumult that has followed?
Well, my reaction was is that it's unacceptable. I mean, it really has no place in society. It brings out the worst of humanity, if you will. And as one who actually grew up seeing my father abuse my mother, I mean, verbally and physically, I mean, I kind of understand that, and I saw it. And so I think that to paint the NFL with a broad brush and say that this goes on far too often in the NFL or in other sports is not right and not accurate.
But it does go on in life.
It goes on in life. And I think, as Dr. Richardson indicated, that this gives the country an opportunity to have a real serious dialogue about it. Now, what I do hope that will come of this is wholeness and healing. I hope that Ray Rice himself will get the help that he needs and that he will be healed. And I hope that his wife will get the help that she needs and she will be healed.
When now I'm going to ask the broader question to everybody listening and watching this broadcast. I'm going to ask you the same question. What was your reaction when you saw the video? I'm not so much interested in your opinion on what the NFL did right or wrong, because this is a much bigger issue than that. What we saw was we saw a famous person get caught on tape acting badly, acting horribly. And then what followed that was a charge against really one of the best football players perhaps of all time, Adrian Peterson. And it's a different story, but it's an issue of alleged child abuse. And yet I have heard people make the comment, including many people who I know personally. They've said, well, when I was a kid, my father took the belt to me or my mother took the belt to me or I got hit. So how common is how common is the Adrian Peterson case is another question that I want to discuss. And I want to get everybody's reaction to we're about to go to a break, so I don't want to get into the discussion right now. But I do want to ask that question as well. When you look at both of these cases, depending on your own personal experience, how much Richard Boykin was very candid tonight to open his comments with revelation about his domestic family. What has been your experience? Did you suffer from that when you were growing up? Are you suffering from that now? Let's have a discussion. 1-800-723-8289 from coast to coast and border to border. I'm Bruce Dumont.
Everyone loves vacationing in Florida. So why not experience it as it was meant to be? Where turquoise Gulf waters meet tranquil island beaches. Feel the powder soft sand between your toes. Revel in a glorious island sunset. Shop the boutiques of a seaside village. Ride horseback along tranquil waters. This is Bradenton, Anna Maria Island, Longboat Key. Real, authentic Florida, where you can discover an intimate downtown and sip cappuccino at a sidewalk cafe. Catch fresh fish for dinner. Even tour a working winery. Just minutes from all the rest Florida has to offer. Bradenton, Anna Maria Island, Longboat Key. Plan your visit online at BradentonGulfIslands.com. That's BradentonGulfIslands.com.
From Palm Palm Springs, California, to Poughkeepsie, New York. You're listening to Beyond the Beltway. Thank you very much for joining us. Dr. Richardson, I want to pick up on that point that we were talking about before the break, and that is the drawing, juxtaposing the two stories. Tell us about what we should be concerned about.
Well, one is that we have to make a distinction between physical discipline or corporal punishment and actual physical abuse. In most states, there are no laws against corporal punishment, particularly here in Illinois, which I'm more familiar with. You can physically discipline your child. And so what I am concerned about is that we don't assume that because we're talking about domestic violence, that that's the same as corporal punishment. It is not. Now, if you go too far, where there's marks and bruises and those sorts of things, then we move into the area of abuse. But physical discipline is still within the purview of a parent to use if they choose to do so.
Have you seen domestic violence in your life, Anthony?
No, I haven't seen any domestic violence in my life, but I can tell you from experience in the past, I mean, just by going by what the doctor just stated here, physical violence, abuse, it's a thin line when you're raising kids. And, you know, I think I was dancing, well, my parents at least danced on that line on a consistent basis with me early in life. But as you know, as you grow older, you get you know more wisdom and everything, you go to see things in a different light.
Are you played football, didn't you, Don?
No, I played hockey, actually.
Hockey, okay. Well, that's even rougher, okay. But growing up in any community, but certainly I think growing up in the African-American communities of America, if you are young and you're large and you're strong, mm-hmm. the life or the possible life as an athlete, professional or otherwise, is something that you are aware of. That's where the stars are. That's where the big money goes. And so people who are looking for someone for their team, whether it's the high school, the college, they are looking for strong young men to play football. And a lot of strong young men come out of the black communities of this country. Is there anything, Doctor, I'm going to ask this one to you. Is there anything unique about the way we treat athletes, the way we literally train them, that leads to an attitude where they are more prone to violence? Because when you're on a football field or your hockey field, I mean, you know, you see those players getting pumped up before every game. Now, these are big, big guys, and their whole life has been training for the big, big game.
Right.
So they've made it to the NFL. They're big guys. They've been the big man on campus basically for all their lives. Some would say they've been coddled all of their lives. But what does that do to their psyche when the game is over?
Yeah, well, first of all, I think I'm troubled by your premise. I think that regardless of whether it's an African-American community or any other kind of community, there are strong, young people who are attracted to sports. And I think that our sports systems, particularly in high school, will make the athlete the preferred person on campus, which I think is the point that
Right. You
were ultimately trying to get to, and I think that's true. Depending on the sport that we're playing, young people have aggression, particularly males. That's a well-documented aspect of human development.
It's in the bloodstream.
It is in the bloodstream. It's in the hormones. And so what has to happen is that natural aggression has to be challenged in appropriate ways. Unleashed, negative things can happen. Channeled, used in a right way, positive things can happen. So I don't think that's a racial or ethnic issue as much as it is what do you do? What are your outlets for the expression of that aggression? And so I think that when you're treated as the preferred person on campus because of your physical abilities, not necessarily because of your academic abilities, I think that's also problematic. I think there's a duality that exists with our young people, and so we've got to keep that in mind as well.
Amisha, how do you see that discussion and that point that the doctor just made?
I think he made a good point. I grew up in the South, Mississippi. It's big state, SEC, mm-hmm. For all things football. I have brothers who play, and I also have cousins who play professionally. So coming from that background and that perspective, I've seen people go through school and do things that kids who weren't athletes would never get away with. And I think that that same thing is happening in major league
behavior.
Sports.
Behavior.
Yes. At the end of the day, if you're the sport that's bringing a predominant amount of money to the right. school, to the county, wherever it is you happen to be, then there is a circle of protection that surrounds you regardless of what you do. I literally watched a guy punch his girlfriend in the face in high school. Nothing happened to him. He was a star quarterback.
Well,
I want to follow up. What did you do about that?
Me personally?
Yeah.
I couldn't do anything about it. I can be a witness that it happened, but he did it in an open space. A whole group of people saw it.
But again, police were not called.
No.
Okay. And the woman involved did not report it to anybody.
No.
All right. So that gets back to something else that we've talked about is there is a behavior that can be acceptable because people don't say anything about it early on.
People don't say anything about it. She got called to the principal's office. She talked about it with him. Somehow he helped ease it. I don't know exactly how that went, but
okay.
the guy was still playing that Friday.
He was the star quarterback, and my point is whether they're black or white athletes in our society, and it starts at a very young age, there is an air of attitude that they have. There's an air of understanding. There's an air of, hey, I can get away with certain things.
Bruce, but I disagree with that because let me tell you, as one who played football in high school at CVS, Chicago Vocational, I played with Chris Zorich, and I went to college on a football scholarship, played 4 years at Central State University in Ohio. I don't think that athletes have a propensity or a disposition towards violence, if you will, or aggression. I think that that can be found in many different communities, even outside of athletes. And I think that when you look at the violence that's being perpetrated throughout our country, I mean, and you look at where that violence is coming from, those aren't necessarily athletes who are committing the crimes, if you will. I mean, I'm talking about gun victims and people who are shooting and gang members and stuff like that.
You don't think a football player is more aggressive than a non-football player at the same period of their life?
No, I don't think so. Not at all. I think that
anybody disagree with it?
I think I would just say a gut reaction. I think personally, I would disagree simply because I have three sons. And one of them, I would say, is a little bit more aggressive than the other one, simply because of the game that he plays on a consistent basis. I mean, in a sense, just going back to your story, Misha, doesn't America condone this type of aggressive behavior? Because last time I checked, Sunday nights, Monday nights, and Thursday nights are still some of the most watched games in this country, and they're all football. And so they like that aggression. The problem that comes in is when you have these individuals that are not able to channel this aggression in a positive way, and that's where we're having the problems. Believe it or not, these guys are true gladiators in the truest form, and they're having problems transitioning from where they should do on the field and off the field, and that's where the problems are coming in at.
If you don't have natural aggression, you're not going to be the all-star. You're not going to be the one who's going
Absolutely.
To make the team. And so that's something that is coached. What's missing is also the character education of what you need to do in your situation going back in high school of a person who can be the star quarterback and hit a woman and there be no consequences. We're not training kids in the appropriate way in terms of character development. That's the other piece that also needs to be developed. You know, you don't have an adult brain until about age 24. And so the idea that even you as a young teenager having the wherewithal to sort of go against your peers and report that kind of thing is asking a bit much.
Let's go to calls. Let's go to line one, Indiana. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hello.
Are you there? Go ahead. Speak up.
This is Bonnie. Listen, here's my question for the doctor. When somebody just said, you know, teaching appropriate behaviors, shouldn't that actually occur in the home? And here's my question. In my family, I had a father and a mother who were present, and they were married, and they love each other. When you have a typical situation where boys are growing up without a real man in the house, they don't get to see modeled behavior of how a man should treat a woman. Like, my father was protective toward my mother. He was tender toward my mother. He would have cut his arm off before.
Bonnie, Amisha is chomping at the bit to respond to your question. Go ahead.
I know you're referencing to the doctor, but I will say that there's a large predominance of people who grow up in two-parent households with that structure their entire lives who still turn out to be abusers. One of my best friends in high school actually was shot and killed by her husband, who happened to be a police officer, a few months ago in the bathroom of her house while her kids were right outside the door. Both of them grew up in two-parent households.
Okay, but my question is proportionately, now there's always exceptions. And what I'm saying is, how many times do we see these kind of problems? And statistically, the statistics bear out that there are more problems when there is not a two-parent household. And you'd have to be blind not to know.
Well, let's let Dr. Richardson respond to that.
No, I think the caller's absolutely right. We know that families that have two parents do better than families that are that don't generally. But so, yes, we know that that's absolutely true. Very happy that you grew up in that kind of situation. Unfortunately, in today's family structure, we don't have that for every family.
Thank
you very much for your call. Behind the abuse, can you speak to the recipient of the abuse? Why do they tend to stay and enable their abuser, doctor?
Yeah, there are a number of reasons why that happens. The first thing that comes to mind is fear of the reaction of the abuser. Oftentimes, the way that the abuser controls their partner is by fear. Another thing that happens is if there's been, we know that 70% of people who abuse saw, witnessed, or were abused as children. And so there may be this historical experience of abuse. And so
the woman, almost a comfort level with it or an awareness of it?
It's more of a issue of esteem and worthiness. So if you've grown up believing that that's how you should be behaving, then you will seek a partner who will treat you what you're used, how you're used to being
treated.
We've
got to pause. We'll continue with that in just a moment from Chicago.
Are you headed to Los Angeles? Looking for the ideal place for you and your family to relax and enjoy yourselves? A place that combines a Four Diamond Hotel experience with a convenient location? It's the Hilton Los Angeles Universal City, just steps away from Universal Studios Hollywood, CityWalk, and NBC Studios. Just a short ride to the Hollywood Walk of Fame, TCL Chinese Theater, Warner Brothers, and other popular attractions. Enjoy spacious rooms offering breathtaking views and a world-class Las Vegas-style seafood and prime rib buffet every weekend and holidays. Share family fun and enjoy the oasis of the palm tree-lined pool and whirlpool. Relax in your own private poolside cabana with a cocktail or snack at your fingertips. Book your reservation today at HiltonUniversal.com or call 1-800-774-1500. The Hilton, Los Angeles, Universal City. At HiltonUniversal.com, they let you be the star in Hollywood.
Bruce, come on back to Chicago. Thanks very much for joining us tonight. We have great guests around the table, and we'll let them introduce themselves, starting with Richard Boykin.
Thank you, Bruce. Thank you, too, for taking the time out to talk about this important subject. I'm Richard Boykin. I actually spent 13 years working in Washington, working for Congressman Danny Davis, Congressman Bobby Rush, and Senator Carol Moseley Braun. Last 8 years, I've been a partner at Barnes & Thornburg, recently elected Democratic nominee for Cook County Commissioner District 1.
Which means in Chicago, you are an elected official.
But how do you call it Cook County Commissioner-elect?
Anthony Anderson, go ahead.
Anthony Anderson, chairman of Republican Precinct Project, a statewide organization dedicated to filling Republican precincts in the state of Illinois, and also an employee at the Department of Juvenile Justice for the past 22 years, where I've worked in both the adult and the juvenile divisions.
Misha Cross.
Hi, I'm Misha Cross. I am currently a communications analyst with the Cook County Board. In addition to that, I am also the National Director of Diversity and Outreach for Young Democrats of America, and recently completed a very large writing piece on Feminism 2.0, understanding feminism and what it means for millennials, and did a great bit of presenting at UIC on domestic violence issues and how women face those and what they should be doing.
And also welcoming to us, to the microphone for the first time, is Dr. Reginald Richardson. Reginald?
Dr. Reginald Richardson, I'm Vice President of Evaluation and Clinical Services at the Family Institute at Northwestern University. I'm a senior psychotherapist there, as well as on faculty at Northwestern University in the Department of Psychology.
If we could wave a magic wand or blow in the ear of Roger Goodell, and again, he had his press release this last, or press conference and press releases this past week, and he has appointed a committee that's going to investigate four women who are going to be his domestic policy advisors. Let's give them a little advice. Where would you start, not exclusively related to the NFL, but you can include the NFL as well. Richard, if we wave the magic wand and you were on that committee, what would you be blowing in the commissioner's ear? What would you be telling him to do that he's not doing or you've not heard him announce yet?
Well, I would just say, one, I want to applaud the courage of Roger Goodell for coming forward, I mean, after a long silence, and for creating this committee to really look at this. But I would
you may
have,
be the only person in America who's congratulated Roger Goodell this week.
I might
you're
be.
A man, that's the man of the cloth coming out here.
But what I want to do is this, and what I would say to him is that look, this is a real serious issue, but it cuts across all of the teams, and that, you know, he has to sound the alarm that this is really serious.
What should he do, though?
He's got to be tough. He's got to be tough, and if it means – some suspensions indefinitely from football, then he has to do that.
Let me make a suggestion, and then I want to get everybody's reaction, and I want to hear your comments. How about a policy that would say, if you are charged, if you are charged with any crime, you are suspended until that crime is adjudicated. Is that too strong, Amisha?
I think it's far too strong. And I actually think that in this policy development process, there shouldn't be such reactionary measures. It only makes sense from a female perspective that you would actually design a policy that implements strategies to control situations, not to react after they've already happened. So a lot of these guys may need some level of psychological training. They may have had something in their background in terms of domestic violence or other levels of abuse that happened long before they joined the NFL.
Probably
so. Those things need to be addressed.
So would you throw it back on the NCAA? Would you throw it back on the high school associations? I mean, at what point along the road, the earlier the intervention, doctor, the better, I would assume.
Absolutely.
But in this particular case,
I would say all of them. They need to work in coordination.
Okay.
Bruce, here's my only problem with that. The penalty would actually be too harsh if you just go into suspend someone indefinitely once an infraction like that happens. What needs to happen is what came out to happen, just to get back to what you said with Roger Goodell. I mean, Goodell he's protecting the shield at this point. And by the shield, I mean the NFL. You know, it's money involved and it's billions of dollars in revenue. That's what he came out to protect. He knew then what he knows now. The only reason why he's changing his story is because of the reaction to what has happened. The fact of the matter is the NFL needs to put into place policy and procedure on an ongoing basis for the next several months or several years to where if a person does this, this is our response. No ifs, ands, or buts about it. In addition to something like that, what needs to happen is individuals need to become more respective of laws in whatever area they're coming from. Because if they have no respect for the law, then we're going to end up in a situation that we're constantly being in right now.
Well,
that's just this whole...
That gets back to the point that I made earlier, is that if you are one of the chosen few that's an athlete in this country, at a young age, you think you've got carte blanche to do an awful lot of stuff.
Well,
because in the case of that you referenced in Mississippi, you know, in at your high school, I mean, he was the star quarterback. So the principal or somebody said, hey, listen, we're not going to make a big deal. We're not going to call the police. We're not going to get involved with them. And by not doing that, it just keeps them moving on.
Right.
Their butts
to punish them indefinitely it would be too harsh of a punishment because the average lifespan of the average player.
I did not suggest that there would be.
Well, until the criminal justice systems take.
But when someone commits a crime,
right.
It should be a legal issue. It shouldn't be the NFL or the Major League Baseball.
You're absolutely right.
It's a criminal issue. I mean, what happened with Adrian Peterson, at least there was a prosecutor who decided that he was going to file something.
Well, it's not a criminal issue until he's been convicted of a crime.
Well, that's a conviction.
That's a conviction of a crime. So it's not a criminal issue just yet. I'm just, you know, playing on words here. But
yeah.
The fact of the matter is, you know, not to say that this guy won't be found not guilty of a crime, but going back to what I was saying earlier, the average lifespan of the average NFL employee is only about 4 years to begin with. So if we let the justice system take its time and doing what it's supposed to do in terms of measuring out justice, then by the end of that, a person could be likelihood be out of the NFL at this point.
Then how do we go about saying, I'm going to go back to you, Amisha. How do we at this particular point say, and we make an example of Ray Rice, We just say, if you're a young football player or a baseball player, anybody else, and you want to go into a life of professional sports, and you're going to go through the college ranks to do it or the minor league ranks to do it, guess what? When you get to be a star or a superstar, if you screw up and you abuse your wife or girlfriend, you're going to lose it all. How do we make that case so it's indelibly etched in the minds of every young, talented athlete in America? You're going to screw up your life if you don't get your act together at an early age and don't beat up women.
I think one of the best examples of that comes out of the University of Alabama. Their coach right now, one of the major ones in the nation, just issued a policy 2 days ago that basically says if there is any level of infraction, domestic abuse or otherwise, you will not play, period. That kills your prospects of getting into the NFL if you are on that team. I think that other college football teams are going to follow suit.
You know, I appreciate that idea, but the NFL or the NCAA, they're microcosms of society. And so this you know, no tolerance policy that you're submitting has to go further than just these employers.
Yes.
Right? And so the idea ought to be any time that you engage in violent behavior, there is an immediate consequence. But due process also has to occur, right? So to be accused of something doesn't mean that you're guilty of that thing. But I think that we have to make a very clear statement.
Do you think it's too strict to be suspended, even with pay?
I don't know very many employers who have the legal authority to suspend or it's nonsensical to me that we would suspend someone pending their due process, right? Because oftentimes
that does happen, though. I mean, I know of
but
instances
audit,
where
I think we get
stuck. It depends on what area of the government you're working
charge,
for. And with.
Just the charge will get you fired.
Well, I think that the point that I don't want to lose here is that we ought to make a statement nationally that violence towards women not okay. And that there will be consequences. Now, consequences doesn't necessarily mean that you may lose your job. I don't know that there's any research that I can think of at the top of my head that would say that that's an effective strategy. The mm-hmm. beginning of your question was, what advice would we give this four-person panel?
Right.
For me, I'd say we don't have to recreate the wheel. We've got good data to suggest what works and what doesn't work. Character education, responsibility that starts early on in grammar school has to begin to talk about when you're angry, what do you do with angry feelings? And so I think that's where it starts. I don't know of any programs that are effective programs don't focus on changing attitudes and behaviors. When you change attitudes, the way we think about a thing will result in behavior change, and I think that's what we have
so
to
you
focus
are,
on.
So you are really talking about not just the athlete. You're talking about everyone. You're talking about anyone going through
late,
a school
then.
System.
It's absolutely.
Too late. Right.
Absolutely.
You've talked about that. You've talked about the importance of values. And obviously, it, first and foremost, and in an ideal setting, it comes from home. But unfortunately, in life in America, it doesn't always come from the home anymore like it used to.
Absolutely, Bruce. If you look at just some of our population where I'm at, 90% of those individuals have been either abused physically or emotionally. Those abuses started early on in these individuals' lives. And so to come and say, you know, 20 or 30 years later, hey, listen, we need to get something going so we can sort of reinvent the wheel and get these guys on the right track, I'm not saying that it can't be done, but it's just going to be that much harder. We can do it, but it's just going to be that much harder. And I don't like the fact, too, also that, you know, we're looking at the NFL as the mainstay of violence. If you look at the hockey, for instance, hockey players have a propensity towards violence. They are allowed to beat one another on the field and for an extended period of time. I don't understand.
And the fans love it.
And
they cheer it. And
they
want it. And it's a good game when a fight breaks out.
If it happens in the NBA, you're getting kicked out of the court. So, Amy, are we starting to look at racial barriers also in a sense?
I mean, you could say the same thing with boxing and wrestling, but at the end of the day, the two largest career tracks that actually have a great level of violence are police officers and people in the military. Not sports related whatsoever.
Absolutely.
1-800-723-8029. When you come back, we will be here. Don't go away.
Everyone loves vacationing in Florida. So why not experience it as it was meant to be? Where turquoise Gulf waters meet tranquil island beaches. Feel the powder-soft sand between your toes. revel in a glorious island sunset. Shop the boutiques of a seaside village. Ride horseback along tranquil waters. This is Bradenton, Anna Maria Island, Longboat Key. Real, authentic Florida, where you can discover an intimate downtown and sip cappuccino at a sidewalk cafe. Catch fresh fish for dinner. Even tour a working winery. Just minutes from all the rest Florida has to offer. Bradenton, Anna Maria Island, Longboat Key. Plan your visit online at BradentonGulfIslands.com. That's BradentonGulfIslands.com.
We're still back in Chicago. Dr. Richardson, is spousal abuse, is it a mental illness?
I think there are mental health components to it. It's very similar to any addictive behavior, substance abuse. There are correlations between folks who have diagnosable mental illnesses as well as the use of substances. So I think that when we think about the treatment of the intimate partner abuse, I think we have to look at the mental health component as well.
And to what extent it only becomes a crime if the person who's been abused files a report? Is that just in Illinois, or is that elsewhere?
Well, I'll defer to the counselor on that point.
Richard, what's the...
I believe that the prosecutors, state's attorneys, have the authority to be able to bring charges, irrespective if the complainant doesn't bring them.
This goes back to your response to an earlier question. What have we learned about Ray Rice? What have we learned about his fiancée and now his wife by doing what she did? Because when he was suspended, she came to his defense. She has become an enabler. Maybe that's too strong a word, but that's the word I'll use. What words would you have to her and others who are listening or watching this show tonight who, for some reason, they stick around with the guy that's beating them up?
I think
one
of the most important things we learned from Janae is that she is the quintessential abused woman. At the end of the day, most women who happen to be abused will stand by their abusers. They will come out and make statements. They will hide. They will not let individuals know that they are being abused, covering with makeup, not going out at certain times. That's a common behavior. In her case specifically, and for a lot of other women, if people were following the hashtag on Twitter, Why I Stayed, in the majority of cases, it's for financial reasons, being that a lot of these women are stay-at-home moms or they're not working. The guy is bringing home and taking care of most of their needs. In addition to that, children can be involved and other things. But also, there is a mental health component on the side of the woman. Mm-hmm. Just because the guy is an abuser doesn't mean that there isn't something that is harshly effective in the woman. And I think that in a lot of cases, you have to make sure that you have an understanding of what that person is dealing with.
Doctor,
and it's hard
because
they separate themselves from friends and family while they're going through it.
Doctor, you said earlier that there's obviously significant self-esteem issues involved on both sides of an abusive relationship. But it would seem to me that one of the reasons why, at least in this particular case, and again, it's only in celebrity cases, I want to be clear about that, is that Ray Rice makes a lot of money. He's an attractive guy. He's a celebrity. If he is a celebrity, that gives status to her. It raises her status. So even though the world now knows that she's in an abusive relationship, she's Mrs. Ray Rice.
Right. But we know that intimate partner violence crosses all socioeconomic status,
right,
from the very wealthy to the very poor. And so I think that the reason why the financial piece becomes so important is because one of the things that abusers do is to isolate the victim from resources, whether those are financial resources, friends and family, and so forth. And so the ability to leave, so many of these women, 40% of them have children. And so they're concerned about what that means by leaving with their children. Often abusers will tell the victim that if you leave me, I will hurt you, or I will take your child, or something along those lines. And if you have no support, no financial support, it kind of keeps you in a stuck situation. So we have to be very careful when we look at people who stay. We don't want to get into blaming the victim.
Right.
We want to understand what's the dynamic here. And there is a dynamic. between the abuser and the victim in terms of their relationship, which is why counseling becomes an important aspect both for the abuser and for the victim.
On the issue of counseling, and we've talked about this a lot, about mental health on this program. I know, Richard, it's a subject near and dear to your heart as well as mine. In the city of Chicago, or the county, I guess it is, there is a new piece of a resolution that's going to be a referendum that's going to be on the ballot, which is going to put more money into mental health research as well as mental health counseling, because mental health and the ability for people who do have problems to go to some place to get help, in many cases, in many neighborhoods, it's not there.
Well, we basically in Illinois and across the country criminalize mental health behavior. At the Cook County Jail, we got a third of the 10,000 people there who are seriously mentally ill. We've closed two state-run psychiatric hospitals here in the state of Illinois. We closed 6 of the 12 mental health clinics in Chicago, and we've cut almost $200 million from the budget since 2009. The voters will get an opportunity to vote in November on a ballot referendum. Shall the General Assembly appropriate more money for mental health treatment in the state of Illinois? We think they'll pass it overwhelmingly.
Well, one would hope that they certainly would, and to what extent, again, you're with the Family Institute at Northwestern University, but the availability of a place for parents to go when they need help, or a wife or a husband even to go when he or she needs help. How prevalent is it around the country, not just in Chicago?
Right. I think there's not enough resource and certainly not enough information about how to get help. Illinois has done, since the 80s, a fairly good job in creating programs that are designed to work with women. There's a 800 number that people can call around the state to be connected with a program that works with folks who are in domestic violence situations to get help. They've changed the laws about getting police officers are required to assist women to get their things out of the house, to accompany them back to the house. There's order protections, which sometimes are dubious, but there are those options as well.
We're going to continue this discussion in the next hour. If you're watching us on television, we'll see you next week. If you're listening on radio, don't go away. Another hour coming up. Up by a panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by Anthony Anderson, Richard Boykin, Amisha Cross, and Dr. Reginald Richardson. Our program tonight coming to you from our home base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago, where our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. 8289. If you'd like to email us a comment, it's btb@museum.tv. And if you want to go on the website, it's beyondthebeltway.com. And if you want to tweet us a question, it's @DUMO. Well, we have been talking about the issues of domestic violence in the first portion of our broadcast. But the other part of the story that came out of the NFL was the actions of Adrian Peterson. And he has been charged with abusing his child, using a switch to discipline him. He says that he's not an abuser, but like many fathers, he's a disciplinarian. And in the first hour, Reginald Richardson, one of our guests, was talking about that fine line between being a disciplinarian and moving over into abuse. And I'm just wondering if you might want to elaborate a little bit more. Reginald, how do you draw that line? How do you make that distinction? Because fathers, I think more than mothers, want to make sure that their children are disciplined.
Right. I think first we start with what is discipline. Discipline is really the ability to sort of teach a lesson. And then hopefully when I work with parents around this issue, we talk about what your hopes and dreams are for your children. And so your behavior has to be consistent with what those dreams are to move you towards what you say you want for your children. And physical discipline is just one method. If you're going to choose to use physical discipline, there has to be rules around it. Very simply, one is that you don't ever do it when you're angry, that it ought to be done commensurate with age. Also, the child has a role to play in that in terms of, do they feel like the discipline is fair? Children know whether or not it's fair or not. If you use physical discipline, there are places within the body that absorbs the kind of discipline better than other places. We don't hit people above the chest. The buttocks is a great place to introduce your hand to a child. When we are between the ages of maybe 9 and 12 is when I think physical discipline begins to lose its focus. And so what we want to do is kids are able to have more relation between abstract reasoning and cause and effect. Prior to that, physical discipline is perhaps more effective than other kinds of discipline. But again, there ought to be rules around when we use it, and again, we don't do it when we're angry. And there has to be a time that the child can come back and we can have reconciliation, that there's a coming back together when that happens.
You have done research with people of color.
Yes.
Is abuse of children in a disciplined manner, is it any more prevalent in the African-American community than it is in any other community?
I haven't found, and the research that I'm aware of doesn't suggest that there is more. When we look at the statistics around abuse, when we look at when cases get filed and those sorts of things, there's a lot of other factors that go into determining whether or not a case is going to be filed, where the case comes from, the economic status of the case, whether or not there's mom and dad in the case, whether or not there have been other factors involved. One point I want to make that I didn't make when I was talking earlier, and that is that anytime physical discipline goes to the point that there's marks left, we've gone too far.
Or blood drawn.
Blood drawn. Abuse is the intentional infliction of harm on a child, the intentional ability to hurt a child. Then we move into more torture kinds of things, and that is clearly illegal, not helpful, and leads to resentment and the child feeling like they've been abused, and there's very negative consequences when we get to that point.
Amisha, when you first heard of the Adrian Peterson case, how did you react to it?
A lot of people were surprised with my reaction. I'll go back to growing up in the South. My mom used a switch. She used a belt. There was a line of belts she would choose from when we did something wrong. I reacted to it as a father who was disciplining his child. I didn't think that he deserved the level of disciplinary treatment he got from the NFL.
In your particular case with your mother, was it one hit or was it several hits?
I don't think one was in her level of counting. You got it until you stopped crying.
Until you stopped crying.
You can usually only cry led you so to much cry. Until you got tired. Either you or her were going to get tired first. And depending on what you did, the level of your punishment in terms of what you got hit with and how long you got hit was dependent on what you know, how you reacted and what it was that you did, level of anger.
That gets into something that again, in the Ray Rice case, they talked, you know, that they referred to it as a beating. What I saw in that video, I saw a punch. I saw one punch. One punch from a very strong person is enough. When you hit someone more than once, maybe three times, it becomes a beating. In your particular case, you were beaten then.
It would probably be conformed as so. And I would say that the difference there would be I was older. So
how old?
Elementary school age, okay. Elementary school to like middle school, I probably say. Kind of like what the doctor said
often?
Earlier, by like
did,
12 it
did,
was done.
Did you get the message? Whatever you were punished for, did you ever do it again?
No. But you're a kid, so you could do something else that's probably equally egregious and still get caught up. My mom was one of those people who was very strong in terms of you having to maintain certain grades, you not getting, you know, caught up with the wrong crowd of people. She was a single parent with four kids, two boys and two girls. So discipline was very strategic. And I think that we all turned out better for it.
Anthony Anderson, any experiences you've had?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if somebody, when I first saw the incident, when I heard of this the Peterson incident,
yeah.
At first I was just thinking, well, it's a normal person, you know, disciplining their child. But then after the pictures came out, and that's when I'm like, well, it goes now from being disciplined to abuse at this mm-hmm. point. Now, saying that, I'll say this. If all I got away with was a switch when I was younger, I would appreciate that, you know, because, I mean, it was whatever she can get a hold of, and up to and including extension cords. Now, you haven't seen a whip until you get one without an extension cord. A tree branch, man, I'll take that any day. Let me go ahead and knock this one out right quick so I can get this over with.
And a whipping was repeated hitting.
Yes. You see whip marks on your arms, your legs, or anything right. else. Yeah, yeah. It does make a difference. But the point went across. And today that would probably be considered, you know, child abuse,
absolutely.
Like the doctor said
absolutely.
Earlier. But that was then and this is now. And, you know, it was what it was at this point. I guess I'm probably a better person because of it. But, you know, the fact of the matter is, you know, as time changed, people changed. So we have to use different forms of discipline, even with my own kids. At this point, I don't think I would ever go get an extension cord or have to get a switch. We can start taking things away from you. Oh, you like the Great America, the year-round pass? That's gone. Oh, you want the iPad? Oh, that's history. Or you can start taking away those things. Or you want to go out with your buddies, your friends on this night or that night? It's not happening. Forget about it. And those are much more egregious
but
towards
kids now. But there will be a time, if it hasn't happened, there will be a time where they will stand up to you and right. challenge on you
yeah,
on your ability
listen. Hey, listen, it sounds cute, but, you know, we used to always walk around in the grocery stores and, you know, not to be, you know, sort of, I guess, you know, you always say, you look at the kids acting and it'd be white kids and the kids acting like they ain't got no goddamn sense. I'm like, hey, man, what's going on with these guys? Is somebody going to knock these girls out or kids out? But the fact of the matter is, you know, they got away with complete murder on a consistent basis. And I'll be like, hey, man, you need to get these guys under control because now my kids are looking at this as if they could do the same thing. And that's not the case. Trust me. Go ahead, pull if you want to.
1-800-723-8289. Boy, we covered a lot of ground in that first segment. When we come, Richard Boykin hasn't even spoken a word yet, and he is chomping at the bit. We will hear from him when we continue. Back shortly.
Clear the air lanes. Clear all air lanes.
Sven Gulli has been clearing the air lanes for a long time. Celebrate with MeTV, WCIU the U, and the Museum of Broadcast Communications. Friday, October 10th for an evening with Rich Coase, celebrating 35 years as Sven Gulli. See the new Sven Gulli exhibit, meet the man, and dress up for a costume contest. For tickets and more information, go to museum.tv or call 312-245-8200. Brought to you by MeTV, the U, and these sponsors.
Back. Thanks very much for joining us. Richard Boykin joins us. Richard, you mentioned in the first hour of the broadcast that you had witnessed abuse of your mother when you were growing up. And then during one of the breaks, you talked about child abuse as well that you were a recipient of.
And well, now, I don't know if okay, I was
all right,
a recipient
all right.
of it.
Well, then tell us.
To today's standards.
Well, then clarify
that. I probably
that.
Was. I mean, and my siblings. I mean, look, I think growing up in a family where people are fundamentally strong in terms of discipline in the Bible, mm-hmm. I mean, look, raise a child up in the way that he should go, and he won't depart therefrom when he gets older. I mean, spare the rod, spoil the child. I mean, all of these things we grew up with. Now, we spent summers in Michigan picking blueberries, all of us, mm-hmm. and we lived with my grandmother. Now, my grandmother believed that we ought to pick a certain number of buckets of blueberries every day. If we didn't meet that quota, then we got a whooping. I mean, we didn't just get a whooping. I mean, there was a tree down at the end of the road. We'd have to go down and get a switch off of that tree and bring it back. And if that switch broke early, she actually walked down there and got a tree branch and came back. And so, I mean, but let me just say this, that that sort of taught me a work ethic. That also taught me to fear authority. And I think that a lot of the violence that we see in today's society and a lot of the folks that we see inside of our prisons and penal institutions are folks who didn't get the discipline coming up. Now, and there is a
debate, or too much of it.
I think there's a debate as to whether or not a society is basically, or the system is tying the hands of parents in order to administer discipline. I am not condoning what Adrian mm-hmm. Peterson did. I think it was wrong. I think he went too far, a four-year-old. But I do think that an absence of fear of authority, then children will do anything.
Dr. Richard, that's a great comment to hear.
Right. I agree absolutely. One of the fundamental developmental milestones that children have to accomplish is the ability to know limits and structure. Unchallenged, children will be very difficult to deal with. And I think what your parenting styles have to be is such that you're predictable, that you're consistent. Even if you're consistently wrong, you have to be consistent. Mm-hmm. And the idea that you allow your child to grow up thinking that there's nothing greater, bigger, stronger than them results in, particularly in some neighborhoods, negative consequences with police, in which they become the authoritarian figures in those neighborhoods, which puts their life at stake. And so I think parents have to take on their fundamental responsibilities and rights to care for each member of that family, and discipline is an important aspect of it, or children will run amok.
Do you think that in the discussion of in the NFL involving Adrian Peterson, do you think there is a perception that this is a case where a white power structure, the NFL, a white power structure, the media, are looking at black behavior and viewing it with an entirely different set of eyes?
Absolutely. Discipline, families, laws, the kinds of cases that are chosen to go before prosecutors all have a cultural context to them. How some groups parent children are going to be different from other groups, and laws and the choice of prosecutors to bring those cases to court don't have those particular cultural lenses or contexts. And I think that black behavior is often criminalized, and so I think that's part of what we're seeing. That's not the whole thing that we're seeing, but that's part of the explanation, I think. I think we see more African Americans in child welfare situations than other groups, and I think there's very specific reasons that we see that, and it has little to do with real parenting. It has to do with poverty. It has to do with institutionalized racism. It has to do with sort of larger structural factors than just at the individual level.
And if someone feels that they're losing it, where does a parent go to seek advice on whether or not they're being a good parent? Or frankly, is that not a question that any parent really wants to ask or deal with?
I don't think that's a question that any parent actually wants to talk about. No parent wants to admit to having lost it, per se, or not being able to handle situations with their children. I think this is particularly difficult for single moms, just because, especially if you have sons, once a boy reaches a certain age, the level of authority that you naturally have over them is going to change, just because of the gender role. In my personal situation, for my mom, when things got a little bit crazy in terms of my younger brother, she ended up having him go live with my grandfather because she felt like he needed that male figure in his life, and he had reached a time where the belt was not going to help him anymore. Mm-hmm. He was still getting in trouble at school. He needed that level of
male
authority.
And he was probably bigger than her at that
point.
Right.
He played football. I mean, he was a strong kid, so she just thought that that was better. It wasn't an acknowledgement of her being a failed parent or not being a good parent. It was acknowledging the fact that he needed a male figure in his life, and the way he responded to my grandfather mm-hmm. was entirely different than the way he responded to her.
Anthony, I'm going to ask you a question. In this discussion, what are we missing? What question or what subject are we missing that we've not touched on tonight that you think is germane to what we're trying to accomplish tonight, which is to have a serious discussion of really two issues, but they're tied together because of the NFL conflict?
We've touched every issue as it relates to discipline, as it relates to mental health, as it relates to adolescence. I don't think there's no one part or no one solution that we haven't touched upon that can bring more light into the situation, Bruce.
I mean, the young men, then let me ask this follow-up. The young men that you deal with in the juvenile justice system, are they people who have had not enough discipline, as Richard Boykin suggested, or are they people who have had too much discipline that was violent, and they then have become violent themselves?
Well, I think a lot of our, in terms of our population,
yeah,
a lot of them have experienced violence way too early, way at a young, early age, and that's ingrained in their psyche. And so for those guys to come across and come now to, you know, switch lanes and, you know, become more civilized, as we would like to say, it's going to be few and far in between, because they have been so accustomed to dealing with this type of violence at an early age to where this is the only thing that they do know.
When you meet someone on their first day of being incarcerated in your facility, mm-hmm, and you see them X number of years later when they're leaving, do you notice a difference in them?
In some of the boys, or when I was in the boys division, we did notice a difference. We did notice a difference between the way the boys acted from day one to day 300. It doesn't make a difference. The fact of the matter is we had procedures in place. We had therapists. We had counselors. So there was facilities in place to take care or attend to these individuals' needs. You know, in the communities, this just isn't available to a larger extent. And that's where we're seeing where the drop-off comes at from when you go from make the transition from the penal institutions to the back into the community. They just don't have the same setup, the same structure that we have to deal with. And so therefore you'll see that jump off.
Dr. Richardson.
One of the things I think we haven't touched on that I'd like to make this point, and that is the accountability that men have to have to men. The issues of intimate partner violence and domestic violence can stop because it's primarily a problem with men. 70 to 85% of domestic violence situations involve women. Okay, men are much more lethal in terms of their abuse towards women. We often hear that men will say, well, she hit me. That may be true, but the kind of damage, physical damage that a woman can do is quite different than what a man can do. And I think that what we need to institute also is this accountability from men to men. If you look at successful programs that intervene with batterers, an aspect of that is sort of that accountability piece. And I have to look to our communities, and particularly our religious leaders around. We ought to speak to this from our pulpits. We ought to talk about holding each other accountable for our behavior. There should be a standard of behavior that men have. And I think because particularly in African-American communities, the church is such an important aspect of our community, I think we have to speak to that. We have to open it up so that we're talking about that in places of worship.
Do you agree with that, Richard?
No, I totally agree with it. I think that the church is central. I think it's essential towards making sure that, one, folks feel like they have a place that they can come and talk to and share.
Have they failed, given what we deal with, given the violence that exists, not just in the Chicago African-American communities, but around the country, have the religious establishment failed in addressing these issues with young men and women coming out of that community?
I think if you look at it on a total as a whole, yes, we have. I mean, but there are some churches that actually are meeting the holistic needs of the community.
Amisha?
I'm obviously not a minister, but I will say that I definitely think that the religious community has failed, and it's failed in many ways. One, it's going to be really hard to reach out to the African-American male when the majority of your church body is African-American females. Men just aren't in church like that. Specifically, if you're talking about the younger group, guys who are under 35, they just don't go. So part of it is, what can you actually do to bring them to that union? But it's also, what does it provide for them? Because I think that a lot of young people, men and women alike, feel as though the church gives you things that you can read on your own, but they're not helping in real-world situations.
And I would also add to that, though, because she talks about the younger population. Look, these rap artists and all of these guys, they have a responsibility too, not to focus on making money and turning out lyrics to degrade women.
I want to come back. I want to come back to that. And 1-800-723-8289 is the phone number.
Everyone loves vacationing in Florida. So why not experience it as it was meant to be? Where turquoise Gulf waters meet tranquil island beaches. Feel the powder-soft sand between your toes. Revel in a glorious island sunset. Shop the boutiques of a seaside village. Ride horseback along tranquil waters. This is Bradenton, Anna Maria Island, Longboat Key. Real, authentic Florida, where you can discover an intimate downtown and sip cappuccino at a sidewalk cafe. Catch fresh fish for dinner. Even tour a working winery. Just minutes from all the rest Florida has to offer. Bradenton, Anna Maria Island, Longboat Key. Plan your visit online at BradentonGulfIslands.com. That's BradentonGulfIslands.com.
Bruce Dumont, thanks very much for being with us. Nice to have you with us from coast to coast and border to border. Richard Boykin is here. And Richard, tell us a little bit more about who you are.
So honored to be here, Bruce. And again,
we're honored to have you.
I want to commend you for talking about this subject in such great detail. I am Richard Boykin, spent 13 years in Washington working for three different members of Congress, currently a partner at Barnes & Thornburg Law Firm, and currently elected Cook County Commissioner-elect, Democratic nominee for Cook County Commissioner.
Anthony Anderson.
Hi, I'm Anthony Anderson, and I'm chairman of the Republican Precinct Project, a statewide organization dedicated to filling the Republican precincts in the state of Illinois. And also, I work for the Department of Juvenile Justice, been there for 22 years.
Amisha Cross.
Hi, I'm Amisha Cross, Miss Black Chicago 2013, as well as a former White House staffer and currently working with Cook County.
Dr. Reginald Richardson.
I am Dr. Reginald Richardson. I'm Vice President for Evaluation and Clinical Services at the Family Institute at Northwestern University. I'm a senior psychotherapist there, and also I'm a clinical lecturer in the Department of Psychology at Northwestern University.
And we have calls on the line. Let's go to line one. Deborah, listening to us on our flagship station, WLS. Go ahead.
Hi, Bruce. Nice to see your panel tonight. I wanted to comment that I think that mental illness is at the root of a lot of the violence that we're seeing, particularly among youth. And I don't necessarily believe that all mental illness has to be overt in terms of its manifestation. I think there's a lot of subtleties there. And I think that we have a lot of violent youth who have experienced violence. And I think it has triggered a lot of mental illness. They've brought it out to the forefront. That's my thought. I've been having a lot of experience dealing with mentally ill youth, my daughter in particular. She wasn't exposed to violence, but it had led me to read more, to be in more, organizations with them, right. And I'm learning that.
Thank you very much for your call. Let's let our panel respond to that. And I would first of all underscore what you said. I think that, and you've heard me say this if you're a longtime listener to this program, I think that that mental illness and undiagnosed mental counseling in this country is one of the greatest problems this country has. We do not take mental illness seriously. We see the results of our lack of seriousness towards addressing mental health. We see it when there's shootings, whether they're the shootings that are happening every single night on the South and West sides, whether it's teenage kids shooting up suburban high schools, in so many different ways. This is a nation that does not take its mental health responsibility seriously. Republicans, Democrats, they just don't do it. And I hope that this referendum that's coming to Cook County is something that will happen. Anthony?
I just had a question for the doctor. What is your textbook definition of a mental illness?
Yeah, we have a number of diagnosable mental illnesses in a document we call the Diagnostico and Statistical Manual of Mental Disease and Defect. And so that it has to fit the criteria of that particular diagnosis instrument. So I would look to that to explain what a mental illness happens to be. For most people, I would say 1 in 5 individuals in the United States have a diagnosable mental illness. The most common mental illness is depression and anxiety.
And so we see that in terms of most people who come to our practice at the Family Institute and other practices around the country.
And I might add that there are a number of triggers that actually cause that mental illness. Could be unemployment, could be a number of other things that happen, factors in society, things like violence in society trigger mental illness and that sort of thing. And so, Bruce, you're right, and Deborah is right. I want to appreciate her call because I agree with her that a lot of the issues that we see in society, especially here in Cook County, are the genesis is mental illness. And we got to deal with it. We got to do something about it. The greatness of our nation is judged by how well we treat our senior citizens, how well we treat the most vulnerable in our society, and how well we treat those who are sick among us.
And I think one of the unfortunate things insofar as public policy is concerned in the last 40 years is that you had, again, primarily progressive leadership. A lot of it came from Senator Kennedy when he was early days of the United States Senate, is the movement to deinstitutionalize people. The deinstitutionalized movement led to closing down mental institutions, which I think in retrospect was a mistake. Many of those people have been on our streets. Many who are on the streets are mentally ill. And I think what's happened, and at least at those mental institutions, there were trained people trying to deal with those that were there, even though many of them were just warehoused for an entire life. But I think what's happened now is America's prisons have replaced the mental institution. So many people who are in America's prisons, federal and state prisons, are mentally ill, but it hasn't even either been diagnosed, and there certainly isn't the level of treatment. And yet we have schools that don't have counselors. So because there's only a finite number of dollars available, do you put the money in the grammar schools and high schools and try to get people on the right track early, or do you deal with it late after they've already committed
a crime?
It's
not either or, it's and.
It has to
and
be
I think the
It's not
the
likely
Kennedy,
to happen, though, unfortunately.
The Kennedy administration was on the right track, but they didn't do the second part. The second part was to fund the community agencies to receive folks that were being deinstitutionalized.
That we're now closing.
That we absolutely are closing. I think that's the right strategy. Serve people closer to their homes in the least restrictive environment possible. But we've got to fund it in such a way that we don't, by default, as you've said, use our prisons as a place in which children and others receive mental health services.
And I think we also have to utilize, again, the church here to sort of destigmatize, if you will, the whole issue of mental illness, because there's such a stigma associated with it, especially in our community, that folks don't really want to come forward. They're afraid to come forward because they're afraid that somebody's going to call them crazy or something like that.
But how do you do that, Bruce, or Dr. Richardson here, without being seen as, I guess, coddling convicts or coddling inmates? Because the average person is going to look at that and say, here I am, I'm working stiff. If I have a mental health issue, I have to go out there and get my own physician, my own psychiatric help. But if it's a person that's indigenous, that person can't afford it. All they have to do is walk up to a clinic and say, hey, listen, I need some help, be it mental illness or otherwise. So how do you juxtapose those two?
Well, I think that we shouldn't make the decision that people can't afford it, right? We don't have the ability in Illinois. If you feel like you're needing help, you can't walk out of your door and go in the city of Chicago and go to a mental health clinic anymore because most of them have been closed. Mm-hmm. So it ought to be a fundamental right to be able to receive physical and health care. We don't have that in this country. That's the problem.
It should be part of insurance. And you're right. I mean, once upon a time, up until maybe 2 years ago, if you were poor and you wanted mental health, there was a place for you to go. Right. If you were wealthy, you could go to a psychiatrist or a psychologist. There was a place for you to go.
Right.
The people that were in the middle were the people that were barely, they were living from one paycheck to the next, maybe even middle class. But they don't have the $90 a week to pay their psychiatrist for their kid who may have a problem.
Right.
And so they're the ones that are trapped. And if you look at a common denominator of all the school shootings that we have in the country, in many cases, there is this mother, there's this father. Their lives have been ruined. They have tried to get their kids in to see someone with help, and they just haven't had the funds to do it. And that kid goes out and shoots up a schoolyard.
Right. Well, you know, a lot of I've been looking at this issue, and so a lot of these kids who were considered crack babies are now coming of age. And so the question becomes, did they get the support that they needed when they were coming up in terms of counseling and that sort of thing, and the help from fetal alcohol syndrome and stuff, so that they wouldn't be acting out in this way now and committing some of these violent crimes.
Mm-hmm. I agree. That's one of the things that we have to be concerned about, is that what happened from the scourge of the drug abuse era of the 80s, and what has that done for folks? You know, we also are returning veterans who have committed themselves to the protection of our country are returning back and becoming homeless because we don't do a good job of screening in terms of post-traumatic stress disorder, even though we've had 30 years of experience of trying to understand that disorder, and we've made no decision to help those folks, and so we have a high suicide rate for our veterans. That's inexcusable that we ask people to sacrifice their very lives, and then when they return to our country, we don't treat them with the dignity and respect that they absolutely deserve.
Does there need to be a period when someone is coming off of active duty that they have to be reacclimated to society again?
Absolutely. Your central nervous system changes when you are in a situation where you have to have full-time alertness. And now, because of our transportation system, you can be in a firefight today, and within 12 hours you can be in a back area where there's no longer that, but your nervous system doesn't have the chance to acclimate to the threats are no longer there. And so we need to have a better screening system. And I know that the military is trying to develop that, but we need it today.
Does that same thing, going back to the initial discussion this evening, what you've just described, does that exist in the life of a professional football player, where the entire week it's training, getting up, getting pumped? You see the video of people getting pumped up for the game. Rah, 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 rah. The game is over. Mm-hmm. Okay, they're still there. They've either won or they're lost. So there's a psychological response to what happened in that game. Then they go out that night for dinner and or drinks, and then they go home and they run into their wife or their girlfriend, and they haven't decompressed.
Yes, there might be some of that. I think we absolutely see that with our teenagers that we experience here in Chicago. It is more likely that a teenager on the west and south sides of Chicago will be shot than a soldier in Vietnam. And so I think when you have those kind of statistics, the hopelessness that our young people experience, they're up and unable to calm down.
Back shortly from Chicago, I'm Bruce Dumont.
Are you headed to Los Angeles? Looking for the ideal place for you and your family to relax and enjoy yourselves? A place that combines a Four Diamond Hotel experience with a convenient location? It's the Hilton Los Angeles Universal City, just steps away from Universal Studios Hollywood, CityWalk, and NBC Studios. Just a short ride to the Hollywood Walk of Fame, TCL Chinese Theater, Warner Brothers, and other popular attractions. Enjoy spacious rooms offering breathtaking views and a world-class Las Vegas-style seafood and prime rib buffet every weekend and holidays. Share family fun and enjoy the oasis of the palm tree-lined pool and whirlpool. Relax in your own private poolside cabana with a cocktail or snack at your fingertips. Book your reservation today at HiltonUniversal.com or call 1-800-774-1500. The Hilton Los Angeles Universal City at HiltonUniversal.com. They let you be the star in Hollywood.
Still back in Chicago. Let's go to Jim listening to us on KTSM in El Paso, Texas. Go ahead.
I would like to ask a question as to the percentage of malnutrition that might be possible in many of the children that get into these difficult situations and conditions. How could you address that possibility?
Can there be any comment on that, Doctor? Are you aware of any?
Well, that's not specifically my area, but just in terms of common sense, particularly if we have very young children where we have developing bodies and minds and they're not getting the appropriate nutrients and other calories and so forth, that can't be good. But again, it's just not my area of expertise.
Thank you very much for your call. A segment ago, you were talking, Richard, about rap music and the entertainment industry, because We focused our discussion this evening about sports and what should happen when someone in the sports world does something that is antisocial, that causes all the brouhaha that has followed the Ray Rice incident. Those type of incidents happen virtually once or twice a week in show business, and we treat our showbiz people with kid gloves. We don't suspend them. If anything, they may become more famous because of their antisocial activity.
Well, and I appreciate the doctor, because look, we got to have some accountability, and the accountability begins. He talked about male to male, but I think the accountability begins with each one of us. Mm-hmm. And we shouldn't patronize. Songs that degrade women, or that call women out at her name, or that suggest violence towards women. I mean, it's the wrong thing to do. We shouldn't reward people for that type of behavior.
Well, why do we do it, Amisha?
I think it's a cultural thing. Sadly, and I've talked to several people about this, sadly, as an African-American, we don't have the historical relevance between us and our actual culture, meaning that we come from an entirely different continent in which, there are several different countries that make it up. Most people wouldn't be able to track their family back that far. Our culture, specifically post-1980, has been defined by music. It's been defined by music and pop culture. And sadly, for African Americans, the majority of that happens to be negative. A lot of it was light shone on areas or developments that happened out of projects, or what it's like to live in impoverished communities. The gang culture. What it has turned into is something that both men and women relish in. And it's sad because, yes, women get degraded on a regular basis, but you'll see women singing along with those songs with just as much fervor
as
men.
Why is it that the collective power of women in America, whether it's Oprah Winfrey or the late Maya Angelou or others, or Michelle Obama or others, she hasn't been famous for as long as Oprah was, why has there not been the collective outrage by women of color against men of color that degrade women of color?
I think partially because it's a very touchy subject. It's something that...
Well, who's going to do it if they don't do it? Who's
going to
do it if they don't do it?
It's something that the majority of their children actually listen to. When it comes to Oprah, I give her kudos. She stepped out and she attacked Jay-Z personally. You use the B word in a lot of your songs. This is what you do. This is what you promote. Women don't appreciate that. That's not how you should relate to women. You have a daughter now. You have a wife. Would you want somebody to refer to them in that way? She's the only person who I've...
What about the other stars? I mean, she's the most famous, obviously. What about the rest of the Hollywood music business collectively? I mean, I'm talking about women standing up and making this a particular point, because I mean a derivative of that is what started our discussion this evening.
I think it's also have to look
disregard
back and say,
if you disregard for women, what's the big deal about beating them up?
That's true, and I agree with you 100%. You would also have to look back though, and the sad thing about it is a lot of these female entertainment artists are propagating the exact same thing that the males are. From a female perspective, we have Nicki Minaj, who's like number one for female artistry right now, and she's rapping and talking about the exact same things men do.
It goes back to what you were saying, Bruce, in terms of the cultural elite. What if the first lady of this country came out tomorrow and she stated, hey, listen, black men of this country need to respect women in a way that's conducive for society to move forward? What if the first lady came out and said, not just Oprah Winfrey or a lot of other people that's in our country, but what if she would have came out as opposed to coming out and talking about dietary issues? That's something that needs to come down from the top. She has the bully pulpit to address a lot of these issues.
No question.
And
about
it could be addressed through her.
Let's go to Matt, listening to us in Michigan on WLS. Go ahead, Matt.
Yes, I would just like to say, first of all, that I was convicted of malicious punishment to a child about 10 years ago, and I was very involved with, the hip hop style. I'm white, but I grew up with no father. And you guys keep talking about the mental illness, and I think that what really helped me was just even knowing a different way. When I went through some classes, which I thought were just going to be completely lame, I didn't know any different, and now that I knew a new way, I don't know if that's considered a mental illness, or once I actually figured out, it's very hard to explain that it just clicked in my head one day that though everything I knew growing up wasn't the right way, and the Lord did help me change that way. And I had a pastor that had worked in Las Vegas for 19 years. He was cool, and that really helped me.
Matt, we are out of time, but I want to say for everyone, congratulations to you for finding a better road to travel. Thank you for calling. I'm sorry the call came in late, our last caller of the evening. But I want to thank all of our guests for being with us this evening, Richard Boykin and Amisha Cross and Anthony Anderson and Reginald Richardson for being with us as well. And also I'll mention that Dan Dorfman and the ever-popular Colin Bobbitt, our new engineer, have made this program possible. Until next week, this is Bruce Dumont. Good night from Chicago.